You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's been almost a year since the first case of coronavirus was officially detected in Idaho. And as we do every Wednesday, we bring you our medical experts to answer your questions about the pandemic. So if you have a question for our doctors today, send us an email at idahomatters@boisestate.edu. And joining us today, Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, Dr. Sky Blue, an infectious disease expert with Sawtooth Epidemiology and Infectious Disease, and Dr. Daniel Bridger, the medical director at St. Alphonsus Medical Group. Welcome, everyone.
Hi. Hi, Gemma.
So before we get started, we do want, we need some help to put together our program for tomorrow. Are you a renter in Idaho? Maybe you've experienced financial hardship during the pandemic that's made paying your bills pretty darn difficult. Well, tomorrow we are going to be learning about a new program that's supporting renters. And we really would like to share your stories. So if you are a renter, if you know someone who's renting and they've had some financial hardships, please send us your stories for tomorrow's show. The best way to do that is by downloading the Boise State Public Radio app. You can tap the Talk to Us feature where you can record and then send us a radio quality message or email us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. So we'd really appreciate your help with tomorrow's show. So as we begin today's show, Dr. Pate, just this morning, NPR reported that the FDA says the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine is safe and effective. Now, we did have a listener question about this. Victor wants to know more about just how effective the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is compared to Pfizer and Moderna. Victor wants to know if people can choose which vaccine they get because he says, in his words, they would probably not choose the less effective one.
Well, Gemma, this is a really important question because I think there's probably a lot of people that are thinking the same way he is. Let me tell you two things. First of all, if you have the choice, which you don't today, but if you did have the choice of getting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine today or the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine in 4 to 6 weeks, you'd be foolish not to take the Johnson & Johnson vaccine today. And the reason is it's important we get people vaccinated as soon as possible because we've got three variants of concern circulating in Idaho, and one of them is likely to become the predominant variant in just the next month. The important thing is we got to get people vaccinated. Number two, let me just caution people about making the comparison of what they will say is, well, the Pfizer and Moderna, 94-95% effective, the Johnson & Johnson, 67% effective. Let me caution you about that. That is not an apples to apples comparison. One of the things that Dr. Blue and Dr. Bridger and I learned in medical school is you need to, if you're going to compare data, you need to make sure it's similar populations tested with the same outcomes under similar conditions. These studies are very different. The Pfizer and Moderna studies were done before the evolution of all these variants. The Johnson & Johnson studies have been done during the time of the variants. And in fact, if those of us on this phone were to say what would be two of the most challenging countries to go test this vaccine against, we'd say South Africa and Brazil. And that's exactly what Johnson & Johnson did. So yes, it appears that it is a little bit less effective at preventing mild cases of COVID. But that's not what most of us are worried about. Most of us are worried about we're going to get COVID, we're going to get really sick, we're going to be in the hospital, or that we might even die. And you'd be hard-pressed to distinguish these three vaccines on that criteria. They all appear to be roughly equivalent in preventing that. So Let me just caution people that are reluctant about getting that vaccine. There's a lot of advantages to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And let me just finally end up by saying that the variants that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines were tested against are really not going to be issues for us in another month or two, likely. And so what we're more concerned about are these more emerging ones. And Johnson & Johnson has gone through that test. It's very effective. And I would not hesitate to get that at all.
Gemma, if I could just add something on top of all that.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, well, you know, as Dr. Pate pointed out, what he failed to say with highly effective is 100%. When we're talking about hospitalizations and death, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was 100%. It was 100% for the need for protection against the need for medical intervention. Mm. So when you're looking at the efficacy, you know, in all these studies, when they're giving that overall efficacy, they're including mild disease, which is only a single symptom in a positive test. But as mentioned, what we're really trying to do is prevent people from being hospitalized, having severe illness and death, and they were 100%. There were no deaths from COVID in the vaccinated group. And that's remarkable, and that's similar to our other vaccines as well. And so it is important, as he mentioned, to look at the definitions of each of these. The other thing that I'd point out as well, since this is a single dose vaccine, what we're comparing is after 2 weeks after the second dose of the Pfizer and Moderna versus 2 weeks after the single dose vaccine. However, if you look at that and you extend that out to about a month after your dose, in fact, 28 days after this vaccine, they're almost indistinguishable again. So need to take a look at this. And all of these, although that overall efficacy might say, I want something better than that, when you look at what really matters, it's 100%, just like the vaccines we're currently authorized to use.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We will be right back to the Doctor's Roundtable on Idaho Matters.
Welcome back to Idaho Matters. Our apologies, we are having some technical difficulties. So we've got our engineers in the studio back at the station trying to figure out why I keep dropping out. So apologies. So doctors, if for some reason you can't hear me, just finish your thought and they'll get me back up and going. Well, with that said, Dr. Blue, I want to go back to what you had mentioned, what you're talking about with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, because my understanding is that it not just the efficacy, but the way it is stored is different. So does that mean it might be easier to distribute?
Yeah, the cold chain that we require for the Pfizer is that ultra cold chain. And for the Moderna, it has a slightly reduced cold chain with that. However, the Johnson & Johnson does not have that ultra cold chain. So you may be able to get it to areas that are not accessible for some of the other vaccines. So absolutely.
And Dr. Bridger, you know, Idaho still has thousands of people to vaccinate in the current age group of 65 and older. However, Eastern Idaho Public Health says that it's actually registering people in the next group for the COVID-19 shot. So how high is the demand for appointments at St. Alphonsus right now?
Yes, thanks. That's an excellent question. The demand is very, very high, not just with St. Alphonsus, but really across the board with all the health systems. So we are really working on planning in advance and, really trying to to plan out our next few months in anticipation of getting more vaccines and with the criteria for giving those vaccines expanding as well. But yes, the demand is very, very high. The call volumes that we are receiving is very high. And I would assume that is across the board with all the health systems and the distributing pharmacies as well.
So we literally have some breaking news coming into our station right now. The Idaho Department of Health and Welfare and Central District Health have literally just confirmed, as we are on the air, the first known infection with the UK variant of the virus that causes COVID-19 here in Idaho. That individual infected is an adult female who lives in Ada County. Dr. Payne, I want to get back to that in a moment with that breaking news, but I also want to talk about something that happened yesterday, and that is that Health and Welfare announced that anyone getting the COVID-19 vaccine must prove that they live or work in the state by showing a driver's license or a utility bill or other information. Can you talk a little bit more about this? Because what we found out in that news conference is that almost 5,000 doses have gone to people who do not live in the state of Idaho.
Yeah, Gemma, you know, initially, and we talked about this before on your show, initially there was no requirement to be a resident of Idaho or to work here. And for good reason, there's circumstances where I remember one of your listeners indicated their parents were going to get their first shot in the state they lived, but they were going to be here for the birth of her child and wanted to know, could they get their second shot here? And the answer at that time was yes. And so I think the state wanted to accommodate those kinds of situations and not be overly rigid. But I think to your point, when those numbers started mounting and perhaps there were some people actually shopping, you know, where could they get the vaccination the quickest, we did end up having a lot more people from out of state getting vaccines here. Given that Idaho gets a small, relatively speaking, compared to other states, distribution of vaccine, because they're generally based on populations that are over 16 or 18, depending on if it's Pfizer or Moderna, we get a limited supply, and it's based on the people that are residents of Idaho. And so given the frustrations of Idahoans and not being able to get shots as soon as they want, like Dr. Bridger was just mentioning, I think the state decided we need to put this restriction in place. We're certainly not the first state to do so. A number of other states have already done that for the same reasons. And it seems to be more of an issue of fairness because the vaccines for those people that are out of state that are coming here are going to their home states. They're not coming here. So I think it made sense for the state to make this change.
And then getting back to this news that we just confirmed with this UK variant being officially here in Idaho, an adult female who lives in Ada County, this UK variant. Dr. Blue, you're an infectious disease expert. How concerned are you about these new variants cropping up in our state?
The variants are something that we're watching very closely, and you know, there's a lot of data coming out about these, and what you mentioned called the UK variant or B117 was one of the ones that we've been watching for a while because it coincided with a surge in the UK, Ireland, and other places as well, and so what we're looking at specifically is mutations in and around the spike protein. And that's important because that's where it interacts with our cells. So there's some biological plausibility that it might actually change transmission dynamics. And some preliminary data seems to correlate increased RT in the UK with the timing of that surge. So we've been watching it very closely, especially our counterparts in the UK. The other thing that we're watching is the mutations change that spike protein around some of the places where our antibodies bind, either after natural infection or vaccination. So we've really been watching to see whether or not the immunity that we've had from others will protect us against that B117. And for that instance, we do not see a significant drop off in the neutralization when we look at the serum from people who've had previous infections or people who've been vaccinated against the Pfizer and Moderna product. So we look at that as being continue to be protective. And that's why Dr. Pate said, because of these new variants, you know, get out there and get vaccinated because it is protective against that. There is some fitness advantage because we've seen these variants become the predominant variant in certain areas, especially in the UK, as I mentioned. And so there's something that allows it to become predominant. And maybe it's that changes in transmission. Maybe there's a just slight advantage to those who've had previous infections. A lot of smart people are still studying that and speculating on that. So as we mentioned, that breaking news that it probably becomes the 45th state to have a confirmed B117. We knew it was here, excuse me, because we found it in wastewater. So it doesn't come as a surprise. Let me grab a drink of water.
Okay, sounds good. Dr. Bridger, Ambria just wrote in, and she wants to know, is there any recent research or data regarding risk for those who are trying to get pregnant with respect to the vaccine and any interference that might pose to that process?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. At this time, there's no evidence that we're seeing to suggest that the COVID vaccine would affect fertility or affect the those who are going through the process of trying to get pregnant. So the current recommendation is not to delay vaccination for this. But you know, as with any case, I would certainly recommend that individuals reach out and speak with their primary care physician and OBGYN regarding their recommendations on a case-by-case basis. But at this point, you know, there is not data to really make us suspicious that that would affect future risk in any way.
Dr. Pate, Chris wrote in saying, I got my second Pfizer vaccination 17 days after the first one. Pfizer recommended a wait time of 21 days for maximum effect. I had minimal symptoms afterward, which is not unusual for a 70-year-old, but I'm questioning whether my immune system received optimal support to fight the virus.
Well, Chris, first of all, good for you sticking with the science. I applaud that. But I also want to put your mind at ease. You should be fully protected. I would not have any worry about that at all. The reason that we spread these two doses apart, a lot of the public would call that second one a booster. And the reason we do that is the first shot is really designed, and this is a bit oversimplified, but the first shot is designed to cause the increase in the antibodies. And that takes about 7 to 14 days in people to fully occur. And so getting this second booster at 17 days, that's really particularly to put in high drive another part of your immune system, the T cell immunity, plus even amplify your antibody response more. So getting past that 14-day window, that's good. 17 days shouldn't be effectively any significant difference from getting it at 21 days. And it's close enough that all of us would feel comfortable with the data we have that you're going to be fully protected. So don't worry about that.
Dr. Bridger, Greg wrote in saying he spent 10 hours on the computer trying to get a vaccine appointment until he spoke directly to a pharmacist in rural Idaho who explain the timeline for when they get notified on the amount of vaccine they will receive, and then they open the appropriate number of appointments. With this information, Greg says he was able to only check websites near that time and was then able to quickly find an appointment. He asks, why is that information not provided to the public?
Yeah, Greg, thank you for the question. That, you know, I think is a very important question, and perhaps Dr. Pate could, you know, add as well, being on the task force. But from my understanding, I believe that the state is working on having some information available on their website in the future to help direct where vaccine availability is. In St. Alphonsus, in our system, we're working through providing a lot of outreach, both through email and contact from individual patients, primary care physician offices and clinics, about when we expect to have vaccine availability and scheduling and advice regarding that. And I believe a lot of the other systems are working on that as well. So I think there is a recognition of this, and there is work being done to help improve this process and making it a little more easy for patients and individuals to know when and where the vaccine will be available.
I also wanted to note that we got an email from Primary Health explaining how they schedule for seniors, since I mean, there's so many people are wanting appointments. So what Primary Health does, for folks who are wondering, there is not an online scheduling system. If you are a patient, they are using a combination of email, text messages, and phone calls to reach patients directly when appointments are available. If you're a non-patient, you can still call and make an appointment. So that's how Primary Health is doing it. They are vaccinating nearly 4,000 folks a week. So want to know how that is going as well, because the reason why we say this is that they gave us this information. We know how St. Luke's does it. We know how St. Al's does it. We also want you to know how Primary Health is doing it so that you have options when it comes to finding a vaccine. With all that said, Dr. Blue, there is so much information out there right now about vaccines, in particular on social media. And one person writes in saying, so should we believe everything we read on Twitter when it comes to the vaccine?
Well, I know Dr. Pate is very conscientious about responding with evidence and data on Twitter, but it's probably daily that somebody comes to me with some statement somebody has made on Twitter. And anytime somebody says absolutely about something, I always question it. And you have to understand bias. And science and medicine, we're used to critically reviewing data with an eye towards who's publishing it, who's stating it, and what their bias is. And so even the information as we're looking at these new variants really comes down to interpretation of data that is rushed out into the medical literature so people can evaluate it. And then from that data, there can be a lot of speculation. And so certainly there's people we trust who are on Twitter using very absolute statements. And so even in that setting, it would be great to know where they're getting their data from and how they're evaluating it. So I think trust people that you know, always ask where that information is coming from and suspect where the bias may be coming into their statements.
Dr. Pate, Lisa wrote in, and she says, given that an estimated 30% of Americans have already been infected with the coronavirus, should Idahoans first get tested for antibodies before receiving the vaccine? This would mean we could potentially cut the number of vaccines needed by a third and then prioritize the people who have not yet been exposed.
Wow. Again, I want to compliment Lisa, like Chris, for being so thoughtful and considering the science. That's really great. It is on its face a really good suggestion. I would not recommend it, though, for this reason. First of all, she's right. It's somewhere maybe 25% of Americans, certainly higher in some places, less in other places, have likely already been infected. However, we don't know for sure the quality of the immune response. And just like Dr. Blue was just saying, people that make these absolute statements like, well, if I've had COVID, I'm protected. Well, we don't actually know that for sure. We don't know how well you're protected. We don't know how long you're protected. And there is more and more evidence coming out that people that have been infected naturally with some of these previous variants are not showing particularly effective immunity against some of these new variants. It appears, and again, we don't have conclusive data yet, but it does appear that the immunity induced by the vaccine is probably more durable. It's probably more effective against these variants. And so the answer is, even if you previously had COVID, we are recommending right now, until we know differently, that you should get vaccinated. Now, I think the question that is related to what Lisa's asking, that is going to be a legitimate question, is for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, does the person who's previously had COVID need the second shot? In other words, in those of us that haven't had COVID, we get the first shot to kind of get things going and then the booster shot. But for people that had COVID, their COVID may be the equivalent of the first shot. And so they may just need the booster shot to kind of rev up and get the levels of protection we need. We don't know that yet. That's something that's being looked at. That is a possibility. But the answer for today is, if you've had COVID, you should still get vaccinated, and you should still get fully vaccinated, either two doses of Pfizer, two doses of Moderna, or one dose of Johnson & Johnson if it does get authorized.
Dr. Bridger, a listener just wrote in wanting to know how your big one-stop shop vaccination site at the Villages Meridian is working, and also, how are you preparing for the next group of people that's scheduled for about April?
Yes, that's a great question, and thank you for asking. Our centralized location for vaccination is going very, very well. The decision was made to help kind of pool our resources and be able to really provide a optimal service in terms of distributing the vaccination or the vaccine. So yeah, we've had some great successes with it thus far. And as said earlier, we continue to prepare for the months ahead. And you know, we're always looking at the next step. And in terms of as the vaccine becomes more available to more of the population here in Idaho, and as we get more supplies, we are continuing to expand our operations and make the process more seamless for individuals coming to get their vaccine.
Dr. Blue, Mary writes in saying, I am now fully vaccinated, but I've heard that I would not need to quarantine if exposed to COVID. This is very confusing, as I have also heard that even though I am vaccinated, I can still carry the virus. So do I need to stay away from my grandkids if I take a flight somewhere? Of course, I will still wear a mask and practice social distancing.
Yeah, another great question. And, you know, let me just walk through this so I can highlight where we are with the data we're looking at and trying to get recommendations out to the public so they can understand that. And so Sure enough, that's what CDC recommended, is that if you've been exposed to somebody who has known COVID, then you don't have to isolate yourself in your house without leaving. All you have to do is monitor yourself for symptoms and continue to wear a mask when you're out around others, just like we're recommending in public locations where social distancing is not available. So what do we know about the potential transmission? Because she's asking, can I transmit it to my grandkids? And so we've also looked at, in some of these trials, the ability to block asymptomatic infection. These trials weren't designed to look for that. So we have to read between the lines and look at the data. And so when we've looked at that, it does stop asymptomatic infection, but the efficacy for that is maybe in the 50 to 60% range. But we don't let the individual go for very long, and we're not checking swabs on them routinely. So that efficacy may be either a little bit higher or a little bit lower. But data out of Israel, where they've had a pretty high vaccination turnout and they have good data, has shown that if somebody does test positive after having the vaccination, the marker of viral load, how much virus they have, is substantially lower. So those individuals who've been vaccinated, if they do get an asymptomatic infection, probably have a lower viral load. When we look at all this, we say that they're probably much more or much less likely to transmit to somebody. But is that going to be zero? We can't really say that. We can't really give 100% or an absolute. So you have to look at the people who you've been around. So if a vaccinated individual is going to be around other vaccinated individuals who are likely protected from severe disease, I think, you know, by all means, hug them, you know, visit them, interact with them. If a vaccinated individual is going to be around another high-risk individual who has not been vaccinated, then you have to ask, what degree of risk are you going to be acceptable? If our grandkids are in full in-person education, they're going to be around a lot of other individuals. So their risk from vaccinated grandma is probably a lot lower than riding a bus, going to school, and being around others. So that additional risk is probably negligible. But if that her grandkids are high risk or have other health conditions and are really staying isolated otherwise, then need to say that there is a probably a very small risk that during travel, you could pick up a virus and could potentially transmit it. So, I can't give an absolute there, but hopefully walk you through the data we're looking at when individuals give those recommendations.
Dr. Pate, Steve writes in saying, while we are now doing a good job administering the vaccines, we have an inventory. The state-level transparency data shows pharmacies like CVS, Walgreens, and Albertsons are well behind the other sites. Do you know whether there is any discussion of transferring the vaccines from...
Gemma, I think we just lost you, but I'll pick up on where you were because I have Steve's question. So he was saying that the... pharmacies don't seem to be doing as efficient a job as some of the other healthcare professionals in administering the vaccines. Is there any discussion of transferring the vaccines from the pharmacies to the other sites that do have a better track record? And the answer is no, and I'll explain why. First of all, understand that I think the retail pharmacy program just started a week ago, so it's pretty early. I suspect that we're seeing some artificially lower numbers with the pharmacies. I suspect their performance is better than this. But like Dr. Bridger said with St. Al's, they've learned a lot, and now they've got this really amazing high throughput vaccination center St. Luke's has learned a lot. I got to see their vaccination clinic, which is running very efficiently now. In fact, most recently was running way ahead of schedule, and they were able to call people in early. So they've had some time to refine this and to get their rhythm, and it takes time, and the pharmacies mm-hmm. will too. But the other point about this is the doses that the pharmacies get now is not part of the state allotment. So if they were not to get their, if we were to take their vaccine away, it's not that you can now give it to the state, it goes away. So that would not be in anybody's best interest. Those doses are in addition to what the state is getting. We need to be very glad that the pharmacies are now administering the vaccine. We need more and more choices of where people can go. Some people feel more comfortable going to a doctor or a hospital. Some people will want the convenience of a pharmacy. We need both. Pharmacies will get better. And I think we just need to give them more time.
Dr. Pate, is the reason why the pharmacy allotment is not part of the state allotment, does that come from the federal government? I mean, why is that?
Yes, the federal government has entered into two different relationships with pharmacies. The first one we remember, which was the pharmacies across the country were contracted with the government to administer vaccine to the high-risk folks that are in long-term care settings. Mm-hmm. And that vaccine did come out of the state allotment. So early on, I know a lot of Idahoans were frustrated because they'd see the doses the state got, but they knew how hard it was for them to get. Well, a lot of those doses went to pharmacies to do the long-term care settings, so it wasn't available to the rest of the public. This program, the retail pharmacy program, is separate and different, and it is a contract with the federal government to be an additional source of vaccines and vaccination sites. And so it doesn't affect our state allotment. This is on top. You may have heard the president a week or so ago indicate that they were now doubling that amount. I think it was 1 million doses. Now it's up to 2 million doses. That is in addition to what all the states were getting. So now this does not take away from the states. This is additional vaccine that we get for Idaho. And that's a good thing.
Dr. Bridger, Pamela wrote in, is taking Tylenol prior to the second shot advisable?
Yeah, I think so. I think that would be, something that is reasonable to do. Any type of supportive treatment, fluids, anti-inflammatories prior to a second shot wouldn't be a bad idea at all. You could also wait for to see if you develop any symptoms after the second shot. There's really quite a range of what people have experienced after the second shot. Myself personally, I had a little bit of a fever and a headache and a little bit of fatigue after the second shot, and did take some anti-inflammatories and really pushed the fluids and felt a lot better pretty quickly after that. So I think doing those just kind of supportive care treatments is a great idea. And again, some people have very, very mild symptoms after their first and their second shot. Others have a little more pronounced symptoms like myself. But really, we have found that to be pretty manageable with just supportive care. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Pate, we just got this question in from a listener, and I am reading it verbatim. As a youngish person who misses going out to salsa night at some venues, when do you think I can safely boogie down again?
Well, I hate the fact that this virus is also interfering with our boogieing. That's very important. Exactly. So, You know, I think the way that you're going to know, people make all these projections and predictions about when we're going to have herd immunity. I think, like Dr. Blue said, one thing you want to do is avoid anybody that is giving you absolute answers. And the other thing is you want to avoid people that are giving you predictions because there's so many variables. In our case, it's going to really be a matter of what happens with these variants, how effective is the vaccine, how much vaccine does Idaho get, how fast, how many people get vaccinated, when are the vaccines approved for children, because children are also a source of spread. So there's a lot of variables that we just don't know the answers to yet. So it's not going to be in the next few months, and I can tell you that. But I think the way that you can tell is just look at what happens to our daily cases per 100,000. We're still at a very high level. If you look at the United States, we're coming way down, but we've been at a level that's still greater than either of the first two, what some people would call waves. So we're not at a low level. When we get down to where we're having less than a case per day per 100,000, we're going to have a pretty good feeling that we've reached this magical herd immunity that we've talked about. So watch the cases. And of course, listen to this show because we'll be talking about it. And people like Dr. Blue will give us the precise answer. But my guess is don't make your boogieing plans until at least this fall, and let's just keep watching and see if it's then. But certainly, if you want to boogie in the privacy of your own home, go right at it.
Or maybe when the weather gets nice, go outside and social distance and boogie down.
Exactly.
Thank you, all three of you, especially today. Our apologies on our end with me continuing to drop out, but I tell you, this is live radio, and this is the time we live in. So thank you, all three of you, for being patient, but also for all that you do, the information that you give us. Thank you for being committed to giving us scientific, factual information. Our guests today, Dr. David Pate, Dr. Sky Blue, and Dr. Daniel Bridger. Thank you, everyone. Appreciate your time.
And thank you. Thanks, for Gemma. Keeping up with live radio.
You know what? Absolutely. Some days are harder than others. If you have a COVID-19 question for our doctors, we will, of course, have them back next Wednesday. Email us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. I want to thank all of you for being a part of Idaho Matters. A big thank you to our producers, Frankie Barnhill, and especially Samantha Wright, and our chief engineer, Kelsey, for being here today and helping us get through this as well, to Kelsey Black. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Thank you.